All right. Good afternoon. We'd like to open the Joint Ways and Means Committee on Public Safety.
Nice.
Today is February 9th, 2017, and we will pick up where we left off yesterday with finishing the presentation from DPSST. We'll have Director Gablix continue, and then we'll pick up from there, go a report from the CFO, and then we will go into public testimony from there. So on that note, take it away.
Thank you, Co-Chair Stark, members of the committee. Before we have a few slides left to finish up our presentation. I did want to follow up when we talked to staff with a question Senator Frederick had, and I think I could clear up part of your question, which was what we call today career officer development training, where we bring people back in either from out of state. That used to be a course we offered more than 20 years ago, just for what you were thinking it was, which was bringing in mid-career officers back to the academy to give them a week of update. So that changed about 20, 25 years ago to become a program for out-of-state officers. But what I think it answers the root of your question is that, and we didn't cover it in our slides yesterday, law enforcement officers certified by DPSST are required to have ongoing maintenance training to keep their certification. So the requirement right now is 84 years every 3 years. And if they don't require that, then they're out of
84 hours.
I'm sorry. Yes. Sorry about that.
I want to know how they did that. But
no. Okay. But it's 84 hours every 3 years that they have to report to us. And if not, then we have a process through which we get compliance from the agencies. We really have very good compliance with our partners. And then we're just moving forward to do the same thing for parole and probation and for corrections officers. That was the last discipline that didn't have ongoing maintenance training.
Yeah, let me interrupt real quick. By the way, a reminder, if anybody's following along in OLS, when we have an agency presentation, typically their presentations are on the first day that they come before us. So if you're where we're picking up is actually on yesterday's OLS date. So go ahead.
I will say that one of the concerns I had is that a lot of the courses and other things that you mentioned tended to deal with weapons and with what kind of force can be used, et cetera. I was hoping to see more related to a de-escalation of force, those kinds of issues, because what I have found is that in many cases the continuing education that's needed is the change in education that DPSST has gone through, where we've seen a real emphasis on de-escalation and working with mentally ill folks and those kinds of things, that in many cases those supervisors who have been on the force for long enough do not have that information anymore or never got it.
Right.
So that would be part of their continuing education. I guess it's a new title now, but that's what I was most concerned about.
Right. And Co-Chair Stark and Senator Frederick, we agree with that discussion, and we're all working on that together. So it's not just classes DPSD is offering, but also what cities, counties, state law enforcement agencies are offering. And I would say over the last 2 years, we're seeing more emphasis on that than we've seen in a number of years because of all the issues going on across the country.
Well, thank you very much. And one last thing. I was impressed with Portland. There's a fellow named Sam Sachs. Do you know Sam?
Yeah.
He has been putting together a non-official kind of approach of bringing police officers and the community together for dinner at a place, NoHo's Hawaiian. It has been extraordinarily successful. Mm-hmm. And it's brought in a lot of the folks who have been on the force for many years to help understand what's going on there.
Right.
So thank you.
Okay, thank you. And I apologize, Co-Chair. For the record, Eric Gablix, Director of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training.
Thanks.
Okay. So we're going to move into policy packages. We have three policy packages that are in your book. Policy package 102 is evidence-based policing. And we talked yesterday about the Center for Policing Excellence. So this is positions that are currently in that section of the agency. Policy package 103 are agency position actions. So we talked yesterday about HIDA, where DPSST is a fiduciary for HIDA. We have a need there to pick up some administrative tasks with managing the money. So we have a fiscal analyst position there. And then we also have four positions that have been working out of class. So we have gone through the process with Department of Administrative Services to look at those positions. And they're working at a higher level than they're classified at currently. So this is addresses fixing those positions. And then package 104 is additional 911 training. And we spent a lot of time yesterday talking about the increase in new police officers being hired that we need to train. We're seeing the same thing with 911 operators. So the 911 operator training at DPSST is funded out of the 911 telephone tax. So this gives us some additional money out of that pot so we can do some additional classes for telecommunications personnel. So one of the other things that you've asked us to cover with you is what does the LFO 15% reduction look like? And this is on the board. So LFO production reduction taking us 15 is more police classes. So at a 5%, we lose 2 plus 1 corrections. If we take a 10% LFO reduction, we reduce 5 classes. And if we take 15% reduction, we would reduce 8 police classes and 1 basic corrections class. For DPSST, that's really where the dollars are in training delivery. So we can stack OS1 off specialist in a clerical position, and a custodian is just not going to get to that level of money that we would need for 5, 10, 15% reduction. So that's what it looks like if we go that way. Any questions? Keep going. Okay. Some current legislation with direct impact on DPSST. One of the things you asked us to share with you, and I'll cover these at a high level. 572 is one of at least two veterans bills that we've seen this session. DPSST honors and values veterans. We see roughly 30 to 40% of the new basic classes containing veterans. And I know some of you have served in the military and in law enforcement in the military. We thank you for your service. What 572 would do is require us to create a program for military police officers to come into the academy like an accelerated rate. So we would have to create a new course for military police officers, which would cost us money. It would be pretty hard to manage because you just don't hire them in waves that we could run that class on an ongoing basis. And the other thing is, it's not a criticism of military law enforcement, but they work under a different set of training standards and different laws and code of military justice than a municipal or a city or state police officer. So we're really talking about a different type of training.
Totally different.
Yeah. And what we do on that, we do recognize military law enforcement service once they're certified by DPSST. So the training that they've received, their experience, they get credit for that toward their middle executive training, their upper levels of training, so intermediate and advanced. So we do recognize it, just not toward a basic certificate. And we're working with the people that have introduced those bills to kind of walk them through that. We do also work with our staff to make sure that the veterans that are in the basic classes know what benefits they're entitled to. So we want to make sure they get their GI Bill. So we walk them through how they can get reimbursed for their training at their agencies to do that. And that's been well received. 2355 is a bill introduced on traffic and pedestrian stop data. There's an element in that bill that impacts DPSST, especially through the Center for Policing Excellence. Not only would we help agencies analyze data and provide them with guidance through our research unit, but it also gives us some additional positions to do training statewide on race-based profiling discussions and those type of things. So how do we become more culturally sensitive in those type of issues? So those are all included within a fiscal impact that we'll be submitting as part of 2355, but we wanted to share that with you. 2611 cleans up and updates some legislation that some people refer to as the poaching bill. There are employers in law enforcement that hire from other agencies, and those communities now have the ability to seek reimbursement from that other agency. So 1, 2, 3 years, there's percentages difference inside that. So obviously, the sooner they leave the academy, the higher that the return is. But there were discussions between chiefs and sheriffs that brought us in on their work group to help clear up the language. And we've seen it as simple as some agency says, look, if they want to leave. We're not going to charge you. But we've seen the other end of that, where agencies are getting what is the equivalent of a hospital bill, where everything is itemized from body armor to boots to overtime and those type of things. So the chiefs and sheriffs have introduced that bill. We've helped to clear up that language, and it's within our statutory rules construct. So we wanted to share that with you, and everybody understands what that fixes. House Bill 2712, obviously Representative Peluso is very aware of. This deals with officer-involved domestic violence. We've been very active in discussions with chief sheriffs, DAs, DOJ, Portland Police Bureau and Oregon State Police on how do we deal with this issue. It is an issue across the country. We understand what this legislation does. And within this bill, there are some requirements that we staff a work group and discuss training. We're excited to do that and understand the benefit of that. And then the last bill that doesn't really have a number but has an active discussion deals with campus public safety. And I know, Representative Barker, your time on the House Judiciary Committee, we've had discussions about campus public safety. And now under Oregon revised statute, universities such as OHSU, Portland State, and University of Oregon have the authority to have a full functioning law enforcement agency if that university desires to do that. Those are the only three currently that do that. The other state schools don't want a police department. They're very happy with a security function. Oregon State University, as you know, has the Oregon State Police on contract 24/7. The discussions that we have had is that private colleges and universities don't have the ability to have a police department, nor do community colleges, and some of them want to have that authority, and we've made it very clear to them that needs to come through this body that says that you can do that. A school district does have the ability to have a police department. So years ago, Portland Public Schools had a very large police agency. Beaverton School District still has school police, but in most cases, they're contracting either with the county or with the city to provide officers in the schools, but that's a legislative issue that we've been involved in that we wanted to share with you. The other thing that some of those schools have asked us to do is to create a training and certification program specifically for campus public safety, and we've been very honest with them as we don't really know what that is, because what you do on each campus is very different. You're not a police officer, but the way we see you is you're a private security officer. You're licensed as a private security provider, just like somebody working at Legacy Health or at the Metro Park Zoo, those kind of things. So while their training may be specific, we license them as a private security provider because they do not have any police powers. But we've been active in those discussions, and we just wanted to share that with you because that's a very ongoing discussion, especially with campuses across not only Oregon but across the country. Some state and national dialogue, and I'll start with the top and the bottom, and then we'll get into the middle because the middle, a lot of it ties together. As you know, we've had some discussions with you in the past about arming firefighters. We were very concerned. We've been involved in a few committees on that, but we do have some rural fire departments, especially in Southern Oregon and Josephine County, that are responding to serious situations without any law enforcement officers. They have asked us to come in and provide them with training on firearms because they believe that they should be letting their firefighters carry weapons. We've been very honest that we have no interest in getting into that discussion or providing any training in that area because they have no authority under the statute to do that. They would be armed citizens, and we've stayed away from it, and that's our stance. So we haven't had discussions on this for a few months, and we're hoping that it's just taking care of itself, but it's out there because they're responding into very dangerous situations without any law enforcement response.
So on that specific topic, given that I'm from Josephine County, and we have lots of interesting things happening in the county there. And I know a number of our, what we refer to our neighborhood watch groups on steroids, who have taken it upon themselves to go ahead and do armed patrols in our some of our communities. And regardless of, I'm not saying right or wrong, but I know some of those groups are seeking ways that they can receive training. And is so your private security level training, is that something that groups like that can ever have access to, or do they have to actually be with a true private security firm?
So Co-Chair Stark, members of the committee, it's a question that we deal with a lot. We have active discussions, and in some cases, and this is my term, they would be the equivalent of an armed militia. They do not meet any of our definitions, so they are not recognized as a private security provider. They're not a law enforcement agency. We cannot do anything from the private security statutes unless they start acting like a private security company, and that would give us the authority to bring them into compliance, but they're not. They're really a group of neighbors, and it's a neighborhood watch at a different level. And we understand why it's happening, but we really don't have any authority to enter into the discussion other than to say, if this is what you're going to start doing like a private security provider, then you'll be licensed by the state. It doesn't prevent them from going and hiring somebody to come in and give them classes as a private citizen could, but we're not involved in any of those discussions, and we have no interest in being involved in training those folks.
Fair enough.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
And then oil train incident response. As you know, over the last few months, we've had discussions about Mosher and the preparedness of first responders on that. And you saw the state system in effect. We have a very good partnership with the Office of State Fire Marshal, so we've been helping them with training, helping broadcast the training, bringing in resources from out of state to provide training on oil train response. And then the other thing that we're in the process of doing is within the Scenario Village is Office of State Fire Marshals working with Union Pacific Railroad, and they want to bring in a rail car to have on its side that firefighters can practice responding in hazmat teams about how to handle those type of devices when it happens. So we've got the room to do that. They have the funding to cover it. So we're going to add a rail car that's going to be flipped over that allows us to have that type of scenario within the village. So it's kind of a win-win for everyone. So we spent a lot of time yesterday on recruitment, retention, and baby boomers. The two issues, obviously, that we're very concerned about is a President's Commission on 21st Century Policing. And then, honestly, looking at the increase of officer fatalities and assaults last year, it ties into recruitment and retention. It also ties into what we're doing for training. We're honored that we were asked to testify in a President's Commission on 21st Century Policing about what we're doing. The fact that we train all of our officers in a singular academy helps us make a lot of changes a lot faster, but legitimacy, training, interacting with people in crisis, those are all the things we're doing in basic. We also are building on that, as we talked about, in our advanced classes. And then, of course, the issue that we look at is the number of assaults against police officers last year. So how do we prepare men and women that are going to wear a uniform to be ready for that? And then how do we do that through ongoing and advanced training as well? Because it's something that we're all, I think, watching very carefully, and we hope that that trend stops and those numbers start to go down. But last year was a very significant year, one we're obviously looking at. So looking at measuring performance, and this will kind of finish us up with our KPMs. This is our KPM that looks at police officer training. So what we look at is test scores based on assessments and entry and completion. So you'll see where we would like to be and where we actually are. So our targets are being met, and we're pretty excited about that. And now with the addition of research analysts within our Center for Policing Excellence, we're going to kind of refine this and see where we're at. But we want to make sure we're not wasting students' time. So when they come in, if we're really improving their knowledge, that's where we should be. It shouldn't be something where they could just come in and say this is pretty basic. So we're working on that, but we're pretty excited about where we're at with the KPM.
Mr. Chair?
Yep. Senator Haley?
Thank you very much. Mr. Mm-hmm. Kalix, why did you drop your target down so much between the 11-12 and 12-13 years? Why did it drop from 50% to 30%?
In 12 and 13 is when we started to really move away from death by PowerPoint and into more scenario-based instructor-led training. So we wanted to basically have a flex in that system to reflect that big change.
Check.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. So this is regional training. So this is off-campus training, advanced training programs. So what we look at here is for the people that attend the training, what do they value that training at? Was it a good use of their time? Did they walk away with new information? And here we look at it on a scale of 1 to 7. And what we're honestly looking at is, are we at a 6 or above? And you see that number kind of fluctuates. So some classes are not that exciting. So bloodborne pathogen, CPR, first aid, not much we could do to make that exciting. But when you look at some of the training we do, like active shooter and those type of things, obviously the mental health, which we're spending a lot of time in, we're getting a lot of good results because officers want to know how to interact with people in crisis, and they really do appreciate that training.
I gave you a funny look because I've been teaching CPR and bloodborne pathogens for 20 years, and I make them very exciting.
Coach or Stark, perhaps afterwards we'll connect and figure out what we can do to beef up our program.
Posse John and Bus, that was exciting.
Thank you. This is the same KPM, but this is on our fire training program, so you could see where we are and where our target is. Our target is at 90%. You could see we're exceeding where we should be, and we're at 90 and above. And again, we're doing a lot of hands-on skills training. We're doing a lot of skills that they understand are going to help prevent them from being injured. And we do spend a lot of time with our Code 3 driver training program, hands-on in a skid truck. And we've had a number of success stories where people have learned how to avoid a skid or get out of a skid where they've been able to walk away from an accident that potentially would have been happening. So the more hands-on things we do, the more they appreciate it because they see the benefit of that. Professional standards, so this is the number of cases that we move forward for revocation and denial appealed that are upheld at the appellate level. This is a KPM that we take very seriously because we realize that we move forward a professional standards case, an officer certification and their livelihood is in the balance. So we don't want to get this wrong. So the work we do with our policy committee, with our board, and the staff work, we want to make sure that when we move forward to a revocation, that it's upheld and we move forward to a contested case hearing, and our batting average is pretty good in that category. Corrections officer training, this is something we established in 2013. Looks at the same thing really we did before for police. So you could see where our targets are, and you could see where we're going there. A lot of the same things there. And one of the things, because you wonder why we started in 13, years ago we also trained the Department of Corrections students at DPSST, but they no longer come to our basic program. They do their training in-house, but DPSST has audit staff to make sure that they're in compliance with the state standards. So this was a new KPM we looked at, very much like for police, to make sure that we're meeting their needs as well for basic. Records accuracy. So DPSST is a trustee of 41,000 active records and probably more than 100,000 records within our system of police officers, corrections officers, firefighters, 911 operators, private security professionals that use our system to basically track them to make sure that they're current with state standards, that they're meeting their maintenance standards. And we want to make sure when agencies contact us for their records that they're current. So that's one of the things that's pretty important for us in our professional standards section. And you could see through the KPM that where we are and where our actual target is, and we're doing pretty good on that based on their feedback. We gather that whenever they make a request for information. We also gather that through survey instruments to see, you know, when you get our records back, are they current with what you're looking at? We've also made some electronic changes so they could see what's in the system, and we can make upgrades ongoing with that. Customer service, again, ties into the agency overall. We do this through survey on an annual basis, as all state partners do in public safety. And we ask about our accuracy, our availability of information, our expertise, our helpfulness, our timeliness, and our overall customer service stance, if you will, towards serving our constituents. You could see where we benchmark against 12, 14, and 16, and that where our actual target is. We would love to be at 100% customer service. That's obviously the goal. But we're doing a pretty good job in this category, but it doesn't mean we rest on our laurels. It's something we deal with on a daily basis, and it's one of the values of the agency. And that wraps up our presentation. So, Mr. Chair, I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Any questions before we go on to CFO?
Is there one?
Senator Frederick.
Thank you very much. We have had in the City of Portland, the DOJ a settlement on that, as well as the most recent articles that just came out and were reported on the Tribune. I'm not sure how DPSST, quite frankly, is connected with those, but it would be nice to know if you were.
Co-Chair Stark and Senator Fredericks, we are and we aren't. And what I mean by that is that when USDOJ was looking into the Portland Police Bureau, they did come to the Academy and look at the basic 16-week program that we provide as part of their review. They were very pleased with what we're doing. We engage with the data-led policing and evidence-based training, and we continue to do that. So they were very happy with what was happening at the Basic Academy. When we looked at the final analysis, one of the things that we saw with Portland, a recommendation for their in-service training in advanced, dealt with interacting with people in crisis, and they said that there should be a partnership, not just police officers teaching that, but also a mental health practitioner. We took that finding and looked at our program, and we are doing the same thing now that DOJ recommended to Portland. So we were doing the same thing. We used to have a law enforcement officer teaching how to interact with people in crisis. We originally worked with Lines for Life, which is a nonprofit in Portland. We brought them in to be a partner with us in our training program, so they were giving us that second person in the classroom. And then through Last Biennium, when we added the two positions within our mental health unit, they're helping pick up that as well. But we're doing that on an ongoing basis, so that just made sense. The other thing that we look at are other consent degrees. So we've recently looked at Baltimore. We've also looked at Chicago. One of the things that DOJ recognized in the Chicago decree was students graduating their police academy. I think one out of six understood use of force guidelines from the academy, which is something that we're excited that we don't have that issue in Oregon. all of our students graduating the academy understand our use of force protocols and our statutes. So we constantly look at that, and not that we benchmark against it, but we look at that from a training perspective, which is, if this happened here, how would we look at it from the academy? So we want to see if there's things that we need to tighten up or things that we need to modify in the academy.
Thank you.
Okay.
Any other questions? All right. So we have Michelle Lisper. Did I say it right?
Correct.
All right. Chief Financial Officer. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, co-chairs.
Welcome.
Thank you, and committee members. I'm Michelle Lisper with the Chief Financial Office, and I'm going to walk you through a presentation. For the most part, it's going to be similar to other presentations you'll see from our office and from my peers. So to start off with, for DPSST, the emerging issues, and I'll be speaking directly to the governor's budget at a very high level. So some of the emerging issues that we dealt with in the governor's budget was hiring practices, as mentioned previously, about retirements for affecting the local communities and state agencies, and that it remains to be an issue, as Eric's described the silver tsunami. The increased costs related to litigation, there are unknown costs that come up due periodically. The continued increase requests for constituents wanting specialized types of training, and as he mentioned, mental health concerns. And the escalating requests from constituents on active shooter preparedness training. Those were some of the key emerging issues that we dealt with in the governor's budget. What you see here is an expenditure history. So you're seeing actuals to ledge approved to the governor's budget. And what you see here are, you'll see the introduction, and I'll start with the federal funds, which predominantly for them was when they picked up HIDA. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Picked up the HIDA program, and most of that goes out, as I'll talk later, as special payments, but they do the administrative function. So $6.7 million is the overall program. Their administrative piece is very small to that. Other funds, as you will see there, the growth in the other funds, predominantly the other funds is what we talked about, or Eric's talked about, was the criminal fine account, which is a fungible GF account, meaning that whatever is not awarded from the criminal fine account is swept back, or the balance of it gets swept back into the general fund. And you'll see a little bit, all their general fund is for debt service. So it is, none of it is for any administrative functions for that agency. But most of their programs are run through other funds. And this slide is basically splitting out what the governor's budget is by the expenditure categories. Just to get an idea, you can see debt services, 16% of their budget. Yeah. A good majority of their budget, 51%, is personal services. I think that's pretty obvious because they spend most of their time dealing with training and the staff. Services and supplies is 22%, which addresses their administrative and operational needs. And the HIDA, the majority of that special payments are HIDA payments, so you do have the public safety and the fallen firefighters funds and special payments that go out. This chart gives you an idea of the revenue history, and you'll see from this particular chart, as the large green is the criminal fines account, which functions, as I mentioned before, and Eric's went into great detail, overall for the demand for training from state agencies. That's the big bulk of the revenue that they obtain. And most of this is pretty self-explanatory. So investments. In the governor's budget, we invested, as Eric's talked about, the 911 training, continuation of the evidence-based policing practice that we supported, and that's a grant of about $730,000, correct me, from CJC. The support of agency positions. Eric's talks a little bit about the fact that there are some cleanup and technical adjustments about people working out of class and supporting those efforts of people are being paid for the work that they actually perform. And the rest of it, which is a small piece, costs for Department of Justice, meaning AG costs and state government service charges. Other investments, promoting the student-led, and I wanted to talk a little bit about this because it was recognized in the governor's budget that the organization is looking to improve the way they train and they learn every day by getting feedback from their constituents, from the students, and having peers train peers has been a positive feedback you can see from the customer service. And that was something that, as far as investments goes, that the agency is doing. And they're actively working currently on an online system for private security. And it's my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong here, but most of that is to allow them to do online payments, which makes it and go faster rather than waiting for a check to come in the mail for their certification or their licensing fees. Reductions from the governor's budget. The reduction in the governor's budget is we did reduce, they were at 17, including, as Eric's talked about, from the 16th session, they had 17 criminal justice training classes. For the 17-19 budget, we reduced the training classes down to 15, which reduced the amount of criminal fines account funding that they actually needed. That was basically their portion and contribution with the cutbacks and the shortfall for this particular agency. You will see over time, though, the investment in CFA and training classes has increased them from what was originally in prior budgets. And with that, if there are any questions that I possibly answer, I will.
Any questions? I think we're covered. Thank you. Thanks. So that concludes our agency overview. And we will now move to public testimony on House Bill 5034. Continuing on. And let's see, I'll call up a couple of you at a time, even though you may not have come together. First, we'll call Commissioner Jay Bozovich with Lane County Association of Oregon Counties and Nicole Palmateer with Oregon Fire Chiefs Association. So, Jay, if you will go first and Nicole will go second, unless you guys have already duped that out.
Thank you, Co-Chair Stark, members of the subcommittee. My name is Jay Bozovich. I'm a Lane County Commissioner, but I'm also the co-chair of the Association of Oregon County's Public Safety Committee. I'd like to start out by thanking the thousands of law enforcement, firefighters, and 911 dispatchers in Oregon for keeping us safe. Lane County's budget has been one of the hardest hit in recent years, not quite as hard as Josephine's, leaving our public safety system operating at a bare minimum, but with strong cooperation of law enforcement at all levels within the county and in the region, we are able to skate by. The success of this coordination is based on the effective training that our first responders receive at DPSST. Thank you to Director Gablix and the Board of on Public Safety and Standards and Training for their leadership in making sure our public safety personnel in Oregon receive the best training possible while maintaining the level of professionalism we expect from those same personnel. Counties heavily rely on the success of DPSST, and we ask that you continue to fully fund the agency's budget. Excuse me. We also support all the policy option packages. We recognize that training costs while public safety personnel are at the academy are paid for, reducing the burdens counties might have. Regional trainings and enhanced leadership training like the Center for Policing Excellence also allow our local public safety personnel the ability to receive first-class education in a coordinated fashion. Public safety agencies around the state are facing high demands for hiring new employees. We remain concerned about the wait time needed to get new recruits into the academy. We are particularly concerned about the co-chair's budget framework mentioning cuts to basic academies for these recruits, which the co-chairs mentioned would put further burden on an already struggling local government to pay additional salaries or risk losing new applicants while they wait for an academy class to begin. And I want to say I'm personally concerned that an environment where minority and disadvantaged communities have questions about police behaviors and tactics during interactions with their communities, that any reductions in training in the training system for law enforcement officers will appear that those concerns are not being heard or acted upon. We also depend heavily on DPSST for mental health crisis intervention training and to avoid unnecessary escalation in interactions with those people. We ask that you fully consider the effects of these cuts and would have the local governments and the public safety systems in the communities across Oregon. Despite these challenges, we remain optimistic to work through them with you this session. And again, thank you for the leadership and staff at the Academy for producing some of the nation's best public safety personnel. And thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today.
Any questions for the commissioner? All right, go ahead.
Co-Chair Stark, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nicole Palmatier, here today on behalf of the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association. We're here today to simply offer our overwhelming support for the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training and their budget for the 2017-19 biennium. DPSST is an incredibly valuable partner to us. They maintain the standards for public safety throughout the state. As was referenced in the presentation before, we're facing new and unprecedented challenges in all areas of public safety. The fire service is not excluded from that. DPSST helps us to stay at the forefront of that and help to be able to respond at a moment's notice and help to keep our citizens safe. And we appreciate your time. We ask for your support for their budget.
Thank you. Any questions? All right. Thank you both of you for your testimony. We'll call up the next panel, which will include Chief Roberts from Pendleton Police Department, Chief Teague from Kaiser Police Department, and Sheriff Meyer from Marion County Sheriff's Office. Hopefully I pronounce the names correctly.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Stark, members of the committee. My name is Stuart Roberts. I'm the Chief of Police in Pendleton. I'm here today to advocate for the DPSST budget and to provide a rural perspective. You know, earlier today, I spent about 2.5 hours at the academy providing instruction and organizational change and development in a new program that we have for leadership training for command staff that aspire to be police chiefs. And some of the tenets that were discussed were specific to collaboration and assessment and communication and, above all else, humility. I believe that DPSST embodies many of these fundamental character traits and provides a service that is not only much needed, but appropriate from the standpoint of they are communicative, they are collaborative, but they're not without challenges. More specifically, Oregon demographically, about 60+% of the agencies have 10 or fewer personnel. And so when those agencies encounter a void in terms of vacancies of personnel and go through the arduous process of trying to identify and recruit and retain quality personnel to employ, the next challenge or hurdle is to try to get them into an academy class. It used to be that you could reserve a class 90 days in advance, but now you must submit all the paperwork after you've made a hiring decision and wait for a response from DPSST before you actually know what the academy date is. I mention that merely because if you're an agency of 2 to 5 to 10 personnel and you have a vacancy or more than a vacancy and you're waiting, not knowing exactly how long it's going to take to get the person in there, it has implications as far as ongoing fiscal consideration, as well as when is this person potentially going to become a resource. And for me, I have a personal experience where I had 6 vacancies earlier or last year. I filled a number of them in a number of different ways, but it basically came down to 2 basic academy students that I needed to get into the the academy. I submitted all the paperwork at the same time. When I received the response back, one was a three-month wait, the other was a six-month wait. Well, it doesn't make a tremendous amount of sense for me to pay these individuals, because there's only a certain amount of orientation I can do in a 3 or 6 month period of time, and then I'm paying them for nothing. So strategically, I typically wait until closer to the academy date to actually start paying them and do the orientation, send them to the academy, bring them back, and then put them in a field training program. The six-month individual actually decided not to take the position. He went to a larger agency that could employ him earlier, and I still haven't filled that vacancy. So that's a challenge in and of itself for smaller rural communities. We're to the point now where in my region, my agency is actually providing field training for a number of smaller agencies that don't have the resource readily available to them if and when they're able to get people in and out of the academy. It's something that we do, again, to support each other, but there's implications, fiscal implications for me that I have to be able to justify to my city manager and my council, and it's professionally based, so they get it right now, but I know the day is going to come when that's not going to be the case. I don't know that we're ever going to be able to get beyond that, because we only have two regional trainers east of the Cascades, and you think about the landmass that they're required to cover and the number of agencies that are out there in that area, it's minimally adequate at best. I'm going to shift gears on you a little bit and just touch on the high-intensity drug trafficking area piece. I actually serve on the Oregon-Idaho HIDA board. We receive federal funding in the tune of about $3.4 to $3.6 million annually. It supports approximately 20 initiatives statewide that their mission is to identify, disrupt, and dismantle drug trafficking organizations. We've struggled over the last several years to identify an appropriate place to house our executive director and resources, as well as come up with an appropriate fiduciary that gets these reimbursement payments out, and we're able to meet all the federal requirements in terms of reporting. DPSST, recognizing that there were some challenges before us, quickly stepped up to the plate and gave us a place to call home, and does a tremendous job in terms of that fiscal oversight. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have of me.
Any questions? Senator Frederick?
Thank you very much. I am curious about where you're recruiting. Where are you getting folks to come to Pendleton? But other rural departments, I know, have to struggle with that kind of thing. Are they able to find folks in the region, or do you need to go someplace else in order to do that?
Well, when we put out a solicitation, we're doing it on a national scale, with a lot more emphasis on the local region. We're reaching into high schools. We're reaching into the community college there, Blue Mountain Community College, Eastern Oregon University, the other universities around the state. Typically speaking, if we can identify prospective candidates who grew up in the region and are familiar with and accustomed to the lifestyle there, they're much easier to recruit than those folks who are just looking to get hired, get certified, and then pick a different agency to move on to. So it's challenging at best. I mean, I've gone upwards of 2 years with vacancies that I could not fill. Part of it was because of geographic location, and the other part is just the erosion of public trust specific to law enforcement in this day and age.
Thank you.
Okay. Other questions?
I guess. Huffman? Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chief, have the chiefs gotten together? I kind of went back and forth with Eric's on this yesterday. Curious if the chiefs have gotten together to see what the impact would be of the loss of two of the classes. You had mentioned you were already struggling 90 to 180-day waiting period, and that's impacted you. How much more of an impact would the loss of two classes be? Do you know?
Co-Chair Stark, Representative Huffman, it's hard for me to predict as I sit here. I know DPSST routinely puts out solicitations or surveys in terms of what anticipated vacancies may exist so they could plan accordingly. I think the anomaly that I described in terms of the three-month versus six-month was really a consequence of a class being full, the next scheduled class not having quite as many, and them having to set back. I don't work down there, but I do know that they're pretty attentive and communicative in terms of, we need to be able to plan for your need to meet your needs. And, I think the challenge is agencies not doing their due diligence and providing the information. Any wait time is difficult. But the reality is, I think they do a pretty darn good job of managing with the classes that they're allotted on an annual basis.
Thank you.
So before we move on, it just occurred to me I didn't mention to you guys, when I'm looking at empty seats in our committee, I know Rep. Sanchez had a priority bill that she was sponsoring that she had to testify on. That's why she's not here. And Senator Steiner Hayward was summoned on a medical inquiry. And so I know they are very interested. Don't take their absence as anything less than interest. So whoever's next.
Yeah, Co-Chair Stark, members of the subcommittee, my name is John Teague. I'm the Chief of Police in the City of Kaiser. I'm on the board for the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police. I'm also on the board of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. I submitted written testimony, a nice, easily readable one-pager, and I'm going to draw from that just a little bit. I want to note for you that there are few state legislators that have the ability to influence the philosophy of policing in their states. Certainly Oregon does. And the reason Oregon does is because it established the Center for Policing Excellence in 2013 under House Bill 3194. It's through the Center for Policing Excellence that DPSST diffuses the philosophies of legitimacy and procedural justice throughout the curricula in every discipline at every level in training at DPSST. It also inculcates every student with evidence-based thinking, either overtly or through its training. When Senator Winters supported House Bill 3194, one of the things that she said to me and to Sheriff Myers is that she wants to see the Center for Policing Excellence be effective. I think by all measures it has been, and I think she would tell you that if she were here. She also hoped that we would leverage federal funds in Oregon, and certainly we have. Through the Criminal Justice Commission, we leverage burn funds to support micro grants for agencies to solve problems. Back home, and the agencies acquire those funds through the leadership and supervision training they receive at DPSST. Oregon has, for the past 2 years, the Academy has supported and held a problem-oriented policing conference, again, to dissipate the philosophy of problem-oriented policing throughout all the agencies in the state. DPSST helps CJC facilitate the Oregon Knowledge Bank, which is a repository of ideas in policing that work. DPSST was asked to participate to give personal testimony at the President's Commission on 21st Century Policing. You may know that many people in many agencies were asked to invited to give written testimony. The Center of Policing Excellence was asked to provide personal testimony. Finally, the BJA grant supports researchers at DPSST, primarily or exclusively through the Center for Policing Excellence. And the reason for this is because there's still work to be done. Policing research continues to be out of reach for most medium and small agencies, not only in Oregon, but throughout the United States. It's through the Center for Policing Excellence, the online, or the Oregon Knowledge Bank, that Oregon stands apart and unique from every other state and every other academy in every other state in its ability to provide evidence-based thinking based upon policing research to every police officer in the state, and especially to that leadership when they lead their agencies toward being evidence-based, which, by the way, most importantly, is good at reducing crime and the cost of crime in their communities. I'm hopeful you'll support the Center of Policing Excellence at its standard funding, and then when you see funding come up, for example, in House Bill 2355 with the addition of two researchers, that you'll support that there, too. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Oh. Questions?
Just, Chief, I just briefly, we talked about earlier, I don't know if you were in here, about the kidnapping of the new hires from the smaller departments. Is that being worked out with the chiefs? I know when Holly Holcomb was superintendent, a few years back when I was in the state police, they wouldn't look at somebody for at least 2 years after they'd left the academy with either a sheriff or a city department, so that to kind of slow that down and maybe people get adjusted. But I know officers want to move on sometimes, and see, nobody wants to make them a slave. So, but how's that work? Is there like a agreement among chiefs to slow that down, or?
Sure, Kutcher, Stark, Representative Barker. Of course, the magic number now is 3 years.
Okay.
And, you know, what's interesting, much of that is done with a handshake, but there's a work group that we've developed with the chiefs and sheriffs to try to codify that in-house, if you will.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? All right, Sheriff Myers.
Thank you. Co-Chair Starks, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jason Myers. I'm the Marion County Sheriff, and I'm here today representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, which is in support of the budget for the Oregon Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. I'd like to start my remarks on a personal note and take you back 26 years ago. That was when I was just starting my law enforcement career, and about a month after landing my dream job, which is at the Marion County Sheriff's Office as a deputy, I entered the doors of the Oregon Public Police Academy in Monmouth to begin 8 weeks of formal training as an Oregon public safety professional. Along with learning the technical aspects of my job, several career-long impressions that this foundational training imparted on me ring true today. And that was from this training, and it's the importance of public safety collaboration. We cannot do this job alone. There's no one single agency. Have to work together. Consistency, that we're working off the same sheet of music, we're policing the same way across the state, and the need to always strive to do better. That's when we do our best work, is when we're looking at what we're doing and the outcomes and doing our very best. Today, the Academy is a state-of-the-art facility located in Salem. It has top-notch leadership and training staff. The basic public safety training academies have continued to meet the complex training needs of our public safety professionals by adding relevant training content and by increasing the length of time. As more than 1,000 Oregon law enforcement, corrections, and parole and probation officers approach their retirement age, the negative impact of reducing the number of available training academies would be devastating to the agencies, both large and small, across our state. Delays would add burdens and increase workloads to current public safety professionals who are already tasked with adapting to new expectations and changes in policies and practices. Our agencies remain nimble to meet our community needs, but this training is of extreme importance. The Academy also provides a common ground for groups to tackle the best practices in current law enforcement trends and issues. One example is a joint work group between chiefs and sheriffs working on mental health response. I'm sure you recognize the importance of this topic. It's everywhere in the news. And through this Academy work group, you'll find leaders from across the state coming together to vet topics such as crisis intervention training, de-escalation, and statewide policy framework. Additionally, the Academy remains vested in building community partnerships by attending community forum, educating residents and legislators about how public safety professionals are training and allowing firsthand experiences for individuals to serve as role players. In closing, I've had the privilege of serving as the chair of the Oregon Board on Public Safety Standards and Training. And I can tell you that they carry out this vital and important role on a very lean budget. They're efficient. The Academy is collaborative and it's supportive. Our state should be very proud of the investments that have been made into this Academy and the training system. Know that you will have many difficult decisions in this session. I just respectfully ask that you look at this budget and do your very best to provide for the public safety professionals in this fundamental part of our training. Thank you.
Thank you, Sheriff. Are there other questions? All right. Thanks. Thank you for your testimony, guys. Next up, we will invite up Chris Davis with the City of Portland Police Bureau and Scott. By the way, Scott, your pen gave out, so not all the letters on your last name are there. I think it's Winkles. Did I get it right?
Yes.
With League of Oregon Cities. Go ahead.
Thank you. Co-Chair Winters, members of the subcommittee, I'm Chris Davis. I'm Assistant Chief with the Portland Police Bureau. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training's budget, particularly with regard to training. Police Chief Mike Marshman has submitted written comments for the subcommittee, and as such, I will keep my remarks this afternoon brief. I've been employed by the Police Bureau for 18 years, and in my current role, I oversee the training, fiscal services, records, personnel divisions, and the transit police. New police officers for all agencies in the state must attend a 16-week basic police academy at DPSST. And during this time, they learn the essential skills necessary to become a police officer in Oregon. The academy provides new public safety professionals with a foundation upon which to build a successful career of service. After the basic police academy, members go through another 25 weeks of directly supervised field training with the Portland Police Bureau. This is a lengthy but fundamental process to develop competent, skilled officers who will be responsive to the needs of their communities. The success of our organization and every other public safety organization in the state is dictated in no small measure by the quality of our members, and DPSST is a crucial partner in this endeavor. Meeting operational challenges is not just about having excellent officers, but having enough of them to do the job. Recruiting and staffing shortfalls continue to plague law enforcement agencies across the country, and Portland is not immune to this challenge. While the Bureau's authorized 950 sworn positions as of this week, it employs 891 sworn members. This means that we currently have 59 vacant police officer positions. In addition, up to 50 sworn members are projected to retire just this year. We also lose approximately 10 to 20 officers per year for reasons other than retirement. This means we could have over 100 vacancies to fill just in the coming year. Between now and 2021, 385 sworn members of our organization will become eligible to retire. And further, the city's population growth continues to exceed projections, meaning we will need to fill new positions in the future to meet increased demand for our service. Without compromising our standards at the Police Bureau, we have streamlined our hiring process and stepped up recruiting efforts with an eye toward recruiting a diverse pool of qualified applicants. Our goal is to hire 8 to 10 officers per month and to move a candidate from application to job offer within 6 months. We'll need to maintain this pace for several years to come. While we're also recruiting lateral entry candidates, the majority of our new hires are new to the profession and thus will need training at DPSST. The Portland Police Bureau's success in addressing this staffing challenge will be directly tied to DPSST's capacity to train new members in a timely manner. The loss of basic academy classes will slow down the hiring process, while attrition will continue at its current historic pace. This will have a direct impact on our ability to keep pace with attrition and increases in service demand, and in turn to fulfill our mission of providing the highest quality public safety service to the Portland community. Portland Police Bureau and DPSST have a strong working relationship. We appreciate the excellent service they provide in terms of training the next generation of Oregon police officers, and we strongly support maintaining the department's current service and funding levels. Thank you again for this opportunity to testify today, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Are there any questions? All right, great. Thank you. Go ahead.
Co-Chair Stark, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Winkles, and I am, among other things, the public safety lobbyist for the League of Oregon Cities. I'm not going to repeat any of the things you've heard from our chiefs today, but I will respectfully point out that DPSST is the requirement to send police recruits to DPSST is a state mandate, and it is a mandate. And some of you will note this, is that the League does not object to this mandate. That is, we agree that this is a necessary requirement for local governments. But we would also respectfully point out that the criminal fine and assessment account that funds the agency is largely populated with revenue that is generated at the local level. And so while the state's contribution and the funding of the DPSST does appear to be in some jeopardy, the amount of money that local governments through fine revenue and through the municipal courts are sending isn't changing. I believe it's probably increasing at this point. I think it is reasonable for us to request a service level that's commensurate with need. I will respond to a couple of the questions that were brought up by members of the committee in regards to the projection of how to projecting what the reduction in costs classes will be and why that is a challenge. Talking to human resources directors and some of the chiefs in our smaller agencies, several of them have had an experience where they have a candidate. They try to time the hiring of that candidate based on when the class is available. But Oregon sets a high bar for entry into the profession, and that's a good thing. But when a candidate, they fail backgrounds, or they wash out, or they don't, or they accept another position, then we're left with a longer vacancy, and so that's one of the challenges that we face with fewer classes and those longer wait times. Additionally, Senator Frederick, you had indicated had asked a question about de-escalation. We would point out that the legislature last session made a significant increase investment in conflict intervention training last time, and the League fully supports protecting that investment. City managers in Oregon, when their cell phones go off in the middle of the night on a Saturday,
too frequently, it is because of there's been a negative use in force incident, and it's typically involving a person who has a mental illness, and that was a situation we could not, we could no longer accept. And so we supported that investment, and we would like to see that protected moving forward. And with that, I'm eager for your questions.
Are there any questions? All right. Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony. Before we close our public hearing on House Bill 5034, just a reminder, most of you in the audience are familiar with this, but we're going through phases. As we bring, we're in phase one right now, we'll bring agencies forward to kind of give their presentation. Phase two, we will kind of call some agencies back to take a deeper look on things we might want to know more about. And it's not until phase three, quite a bit into the session, that we actually start having work sessions on these bills. So still a lot to happen before we make any of the hard decisions around this. You know, it's very obvious that there's a necessity for DPSST and the work that you guys do. We're proud of the work that you guys do. And on that note, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 5034. And is there anything else for the good of the order for today? All right. Monday, we will pick up with House Bill 5014 on the Commission on Judicial Fitness and Disability. Until then, have a wonderful weekend. We will close today's hearing.
Did you? Did you turn your
Yeah.
Did you turn your
Yeah.
Did you?